Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Say my name.
Mike Florio.
Get the name right. That's all that matters. Spell my name right or say my name properly.
Pro Football Talk and NBC Sports.
Hearing Florio writing any articles about it.
NFL Insider.
Take a spin around the league. We bring in Pro Football Talk's Mike Florio.
Mike Florio.
My name is my name.
With Bernstein and McKnight on 670 The Score.
Mike Florio's at Pro Football Talk. He of NBC Sports and ProFootballTalk.com joins the Bernstein and McKnight show right now. Mike, what do you make of this surprisingly exhaustive overhaul of the Bears' defensive coaching staff?
Well, I mean, it's like when you bring in a new head coach, what do you typically do? You have, well, even though it didn't happen last year, you have changes that are made. And maybe that's really what we're seeing here. With Vic Fangio leaving, Matt Nagy can finally put the imprint on the defensive side of the ball that maybe he would have on the way through the door. So Fangio leaves, some of Fangio's guys go with him, and the Bears move in the direction of having Chuck Pagano as the coordinator, plus the guys that Pagano is most comfortable trusting to run the rest of the defense.
How much does Pagano's work in Indianapolis as a head coach play into your assessment of him as a defensive coordinator? A little bit, not at all, or how much?
Well, look, we've seen this time and again. We saw it with North Turner. We saw it with Wade Phillips. We've seen it with other coaches where they are good enough as coordinators to become head coaches. And then they fail. And then they go back and they're successful coordinators again. So successful, what happens? They get another chance to be head coach. They fail. They go back to being coordinators. So Chuck Pagano was successful enough as a defense coordinator of the Ravens to become the Colts head coach. And really, early on, right, first 3 years under Pagano, the Colts were really, really good. Now he dealt with leukemia in his first season on the job, but 2013, 2014, they get to the AFC Championship game, and then it all falls apart after that. And one of the big reasons is the quarterback wasn't healthy. So, and there wasn't the talent there that maybe they needed, and there was dysfunction between him and the general manager, Ryan Grigson. So I think that what got Pagano the Colts head coaching job, That's what you're going to get from him as the defensive coordinator, a guy who was good enough as a coordinator to get on the short list of head coaching candidates.
We kept hearing how desirable Bears jobs are because of the players that you have there, because of the number of Pro Bowlers and, you know, nine guys coming back on that defense. Have you been hearing the same thing? Is this something we've just sort of taken for granted? Because there's pressure involved, too. How desirable have these jobs been? How much fighting has there been? Or has it just been Pagano just hand-picking guys, just calling them, saying, come on over?
Yeah, I mean, I think that anytime you've got jobs available with one of 32 NFL teams, there will be more coaches out there than there are spots to fill. The supply outweighs the demand. And when you have a team that went 12-4 with the arrow pointing up, with the talent on the defensive side of the ball, with an offense that's only going to get better, a team that was a win or two away from being the number one seed in the NFC, I think that there is an attraction there. It's a hell of a lot more attractive than going to a team that can't, you know, find its own way out of a parking lot. So I think that it makes sense. And we'll see how it all works out when everybody gets thrown into the same pot together and it all gets stirred up and we see if they can continue to win. But I can understand why those jobs are viewed as desirable.
Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk, joining us here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. Mike, everybody has a few of those moments in their lives where they'll never forget where they were when it happened. Where were you during the Adam Gase introductory press conference with the Jets? I'll never forget.
Well, I'll tell you where I was. I'll be candid with you. What was it? Was it Monday?
Yes.
Was it Monday? Yeah. I had a long weekend of travel. I actually spent the night in Chicago because I couldn't get home after the Chiefs-Colts game, and I was worn out Monday. I actually took a nap. So I saw it all after the fact on Twitter. It's like, what in the world is this? What's this flying taco thing? But let me tell you, there was an interview with Gase on the Jets website where he wasn't wearing a suit and he had his hat on and he was a far different guy. I had him for 20 minutes yesterday, far different vibe. I think these guys show up for these introductory press conferences and they are inherently uncomfortable. Why do we put them in a suit? Peter King said of Freddie Kitchens, the Browns head coach, after he wore a suit to his introductory press conference, Peter said, that's the last time Kitchens is going to wear a suit until they put him in the ground. So I don't know why they do that. And I think back, and as far as introductory press conferences go, I remember last year, Matt Nagy and John Gruden introduced the same day, like an hour apart. And I remember thinking, after listening to Nagy, and then listening to Gruden, I'm thinking, man, why did the Bears introduce Nagy today? Because this is not a good look for them. This is not an impressive press conference. Gruden is just great, and it's great quotes, and it's great energy, and it's great everything. And then they play the games, and what happens? So I'd say for any of these introductory press conferences, they feel like they have to check the box. The PR people feel compelled to tell them, put on a suit. And I'd like to see them get past that. Do the press conference, but let them show up like they always do. They'll be more comfortable, especially the first time they're meeting with the media. And think of in New York. My God, you're looking out at all these faces, and you have no idea what you've gotten yourself into for that upcoming 30 minutes. And I think that Jets fans should not put a lot of stock in what they saw Monday. I think they should put a lot of stock in what Gase is going to do with Sam Darnold, much like what Gase did with Jay Cutler several years ago in Chicago.
There are so many times a day now as I scroll through my timeline that you look at something and you think, well, the world is just upside down. Whatever it may be, there's something that just seems like I've lived long enough to see this and I don't understand it. We live in a world where Tom Brady and the Patriots are playing the nobody thinks we're any good, nobody believes in us card. Bet against us. Everybody thinks we suck. They're the Patriots doing that. I never thought we'd see the day.
Well, I remember back in 2004, after the Patriots had won their second Super Bowl championship in 3 years, they were in the midst of a winning streak that ended up being, I think, a record for consecutive wins over two regular seasons. And they were playing that card then. And you know, what happened was in December when they lost that game, that fluky game to the Dolphins on that hook and ladder play at the end of the fourth quarter, and then they got beat by the Steelers in Pittsburgh. We saw something different, and we thought it was Father Time finally catching up to Tom Brady and whacking him over the head with the giant hourglass. And what it turned out to be was apparently some sort of injury that Tom Brady concealed from the team because he's got Alex Guerrero to help do whatever Mr. Miyagi routine he does to make him healthy and ready to play. He's better now. He's healthy now. But the fumes of that experience allow him to put that chip on his shoulder. And that's great. You know, it doesn't matter if the rest of us look at it and say, what the hell are they talking about? As long as they can sell that in the locker room, the hashtag bet against us jersey that Julian Edelman wore. I mean, if you can rally around that, as phony as it is, if you can convince yourself, and look, they're underdogs for the first time with Tom Brady at quarterback since 2014 when they went to play the Packers at Lambeau Field. So the proof is right there. The odds makers think that the Patriots will lose the game, and that feeds right into this notion that nobody believes in us. And what better way to not get complacent after you have all those trophies on the wall?
It doesn't have to be true to work.
No, perception is reality.
Football coaches do that all the time. They do it all the time. Remember the movie with Robin Williams and Kurt Russell? Remember that? The Best of Times? Am I really dating myself here?
I don't remember it. I don't think I saw that one.
Yeah, okay. Well, at one point, Robin Williams dresses up as the mascot of the opposing high school that they want to have a rematch with, and his former teammates don't want to do it. So he dresses up as the mascot, and he trashes the locker room, and that gets, you know, and it was all phony and it was all staged, but that was the key to get them to have a rematch 10 years later or 15 years later of a high school game that had been played in the past. You really need to see it. I'm telling you, it doesn't sound all that compelling as I explain it. You need to see it.
All right, we'll go through that one. what's going on, or how much of a bigger sign is Leonard Fournette going in and filing the formal challenge to the Jags trying to avoid $7 million? Is this a larger thing for players in general, or is this a one-off because it's Jacksonville, because it's a running back?
No, I mean, this is what you do. Look, the teams have the right under the collective bargaining agreement and under the individual contracts, if the contracts are written the right way, to attack the guaranteed money that is paid to these players. And we hear all the time complaints that NFL contracts aren't fully guaranteed. Well, for the first 20 guys taken in the draft, they are. Leonard Fournette's contract, 4 years, fully guaranteed. He's got $7.1 million left, $2.9 this year, a little more than $4.1 next year. And when they pull the plug on that guarantee, then they have a lot of power over him. They have a lot of control over him. If he doesn't shape up this year, they'll get rid of him for 2020, and they won't owe him any money. So he's fighting this because, look, he's negotiated it, he's earned it, and the argument will be that his contract doesn't specifically permit the guarantees to be voided for what he did to get suspended, because that's what it all comes down to. You get suspended, your guarantee is void. Well, I've read the contract, and I think what Fournette's agents will argue is there isn't a specific reference in there to a suspension for something that you do on the field. And this gets right back to all the stuff that was going on between the Bears and Roquan Smith. This is why he held out. You don't want language in there that allows them to hold over your head something that is completely unrelated to your performance, right? You had one bad day, you get suspended for it, and now we're going to hold this over your head, and maybe we'll cut you, maybe we'll trade you, maybe we'll do whatever, but we know we don't have to pay you your money.
Something strange is happening in Chicago and has been ever since the Cody Parkey fiasco started percolating earlier in the season, and that has been the existence of Robbie Gould as a talisman as much as he is a kicker, where the idea of Robbie Gould is the idea of missed kicks being unmissed, of everything being okay, of this feeling of better times, even though he's an older kicker who's had ups and downs, and when he first left Chicago wasn't very good and was expensive, and there was a reason they got rid of him. Is he a sought-after free agent? Are teams looking at Robbie Gould? Will there be a bidding war for Robbie Gould?
Well, I mean, we were talking earlier about coaches. The supply outweighs the demand. And I can't remember a time that a free agent kicker got to the market and commanded huge money. Now, Adam Vinatieri jumped from the Patriots to the Colts back in 2006. But, you know, for the most part, a guy is a kicker on a team and he stays on a team until that team decides he's no longer getting it done or he costs more than what they could find somebody else to come in and get the kicking done for. And just there's so many guys. And every year there's a new crop of incoming kickers that can either be drafted in the late round or signed as undrafted free agents. And yeah, I'd be shocked if all of a sudden there's a bidding war for a kicker, because you can find kickers anywhere and everywhere. And why would you overspend on that position when you can get lucky and you can have a competition and you can bring in three guys off the street and one of them, you know, gets in the right mindset and shows he can make kicks under pressure and he becomes your kicker?
Sounds like Zach Taylor is going to take the Cincinnati job as soon as his run with the Rams is over. The Dolphins are still where on this, Mike?
Brian Flores, the Patriots linebackers coach and de facto defensive coordinator, is the guy they've settled on. There's been some reports about people who would be joining him in Miami. Jim Caldwell, for example, the former Colts and Lions coach, expected to be the offensive coordinator. But the thing we learned last year, these deals aren't done until they're done. And
right.
Last year we saw a coach walk away, a team could still walk away. Look, I still don't rule out the possibility of the Ravens calling up Stephen Ross, the owner of the Dolphins, after they get to the point where they can't get an extension done with John Harbaugh and say, hey, you know, for a second-round pick or a first-round pick or whatever, you can hire Harbaugh. Ross, even if they've given Brian Flores a wink-nod indication that they're going to hire him, Ross could say, hey, nothing's final, nothing's done, and we're going to go ahead and hire John Harbaugh. Now, that would be a really aggressive move, and it would cause trust issues moving forward for the organization, just like it caused trust issues for Josh McDaniels after what he did last year. But that's the one thing we need to remember. It's not done until it's done. Right now, it looks like Taylor in Cincinnati and Flores in Miami. But until that name is signed on the dotted line, anything can happen.
The Rams at Saints, the Pats at the Chiefs, Championship Sunday. What is top of mind for you in each one of these games?
Well, you know, the weather forecast in Kansas City has improved, which I think is good news for the Chiefs. If it was going to be a deep freeze, single digits, there's just a chance that Patrick Mahomes can't perform the way that we're accustomed to, and we've seen Tom Brady perform in those elements. I think that helps the Chiefs. I still think there's something about the Patriots, and having played the Chiefs before this year, I could see Bill Belichick duping to Patrick Mahomes, giving him some look that Mahomes thinks is going to result in some guy being open and somebody's going to be there to intercept the pass, and Tom Brady makes a big throw in a key spot like we saw in the regular season when he found Rob Gronkowski down the field after the Chiefs took the lead late. So I just feel like no matter how the dominoes fall, the Patriots end up advancing to the Super Bowl, even though everything seems to be pointing Kansas City's way. And for the Saints and the Rams, look, another rematch, you throw that one out, but you learn from what happened. And I just think in that dome with that noise, I just don't believe in Jared Goff. We saw what happened when he came to Chicago in the cold. Mm-hmm. And I think with a Super Bowl berth riding on it, I'm going to go with the guy who's been there before, who's won the game, who knows how to outplay and ultimately outscore whoever he has to go against.
And then we're going to see a Super Bowl matchup of two 40-year-old plus
isn't that
quarterbacks.
Great? A combined age of nearly 82.
Wow. Man.
That's
old.
It's old. It's football. So but you know what? It also tells us that the league is doing what it has tried to do and protect these guys, extend careers, extend seasons, and all of our bitching about what constitutes unnecessary roughness mm-hmm. is actually working for the league.
Well, but I also wonder this, too. If it is Brady versus Breeze, does the winner walk off into the sunset? That's going to be the other storyline going into the week. Because I could see Giselle yanking Tom Brady off into the sunset. Because remember when that came up after the they beat the Falcons? She really wanted him to exit stage left, and he bought some more time. And it could be that if they win this one, she says, that's it. Unless you want to sleep outdoors for the next 3 years, you better walk away from football.
Now, didn't Breeze have some liquidity issues? Weren't there some cash problems with him where it sounds weird, but he may actually need the money?
There was a lawsuit with something. He got scammed with some jewelry thing, which was just kind of odd. But he's one of those guys, other than that one glitch, everything he's touched seems to have turned to gold. He's had Jimmy John's franchises. He seems like a very competent businessman. And I think that, you know, when Peyton Manning retired, my thought was whatever he tries to do, he'll be successful at. He's just chosen to do nothing for 3 years, and he's got the right to do it. I think Breeze is going to jump into something, whether it's broadcasting, whether it's just being an entrepreneur. I could see him getting into politics at some point. I think Breeze is going to be like a Renaissance man once he gets out of football, and I don't think he's going to feel compelled to hang around as long as he possibly can, and I would not be surprised if they win the Super Bowl and he has that sense of moment and says, this is the time for me to walk away.
Mike Florio, thanks as always.
See you guys.
Mike Florio, who joins us weekly to talk about the NFL. When we come back, I have a medical explanation. A doctor actually describing what he thinks was going on with Adam Gase. this is real.
What drug was that?
I am not making this up. For everything we were trying to figure out, like, what is going on with his eyes? Why is his head darting around? This is a doctor, an armchair diagnosis here. There's an actual thing. It's actually real. I'm not making this up.
Peer-reviewed science. That's next. Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
There's something with his eyes. I don't know exactly what it is. Did you see how his eyes? Something with his eyes.
Oh, yeah. There was some of the floating taco meme is really outstanding.
Inspired.
It's spectacular. There is a doctor in San Diego.
Huh?
Sports medical analyst, pro football doc. He's on Twitter, too. His name is David Chow.
Yeah, he's gotten real hot and diagnosing injuries just off the tape and stuff.
Yeah, he's got kind of a history.
Yeah,
there's a sketchy history. I think he was one of those who was sued for not recognizing certain symptoms in Junior Seau because he was Junior Seau's doctor.
He's got a pretty good record, though, of being right on some of the injuries that he's seen in NFL games. So for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, he's really good on game day. If somebody goes down and he'll say, look, the way he's cradling his arm, that is probably a broken collarbone, that kind of, you can learn a lot just in.
When Mitch went down, everybody was retweeting his take.
Of what
I shouldn't say take,
now,
his diagnosis.
This is what he wrote in the San Diego Union Tribune. Adam Gase had bug eyes and appeared distracted and or crazed, with his eyes darting around the room and staring off into space during the press conference introducing him as Jets head coach. Some have asked if he were on medication or on drugs.
What drug is that?
Being the center of attention, especially on a big stage, can elicit unique reactions. But this is not Gase's first time in the spotlight. He was head coach of the Dolphins for 3 years. Is the glare of the New York spotlight that much brighter? A review of video and reports recently in New York and previously in Miami appears to show that Gase's behavior simply is a manifestation of being uncomfortable in a position, has nothing to do with drugs or his mental status being altered. The medical term for bug eyes is exophthalmos.
Yeah, all right.
Exophthalmos, right? The ophthal meaning eyes, exophthalmos. There are medical conditions that cause this, including thyroid issues, right?
Like sure, I guess.
Marty Feldman, I guess, as a young child.
Oh, it's an actual, you have something wrong with the thyroid, and actually does something to the shape of your eye?
Yeah. Goiter, your eyes will bug out of your head or whatever it is. It's the old Mel Brooks line. But that was, yeah, I believe that was the Marty Feldman had a thyroid issue as a child. Tics or involuntary muscle contractions can be caused by metabolic, sometimes calcium abnormalities. I'm sure Gase has been or will be checked for all of these conditions, as every player and coach.
Jets doctor is going to hop right on that.
Checked in their annual physicals. It's my impression there should be no medical issues. The wide open and darting eyes seem to be part of a hypervigilant autonomic nerve response, which is not something that is voluntarily controlled. At a time of stress, our pupils dilate, our eyelids open to expose the white sclera, and eye muscles contract to cause the eyes to jump around. This fight or flight response is controlled by our autonomic system, is not directly controlled by Gase's intention.
Oh, okay, good.
This is the reaction who is uncomfortable, of someone who's uncomfortable and looking for potential danger. In fact, the American Revolutionary War phrase, "Don't fire until you see the whites of the eyes," is rooted in this response. The whites of one's eyes are easier to see in a combatant who is on full alert.
Huh.
The accentuated lateral gaze can be classified as a tic. When Gase is speaking or engaged, it seems to disappear. When he's sitting and not moving, it's unmasked. This is much like how a Tourette's tic is exposed at rest. An elderly person's tremor is improved as they shave or feed themselves, while their hand is shaky when not performing a task. Further evidence the responses are not pathologic or drug-induced is the peer when he was interviewed in breakout interview sessions off of the podium. He was lucid and clear, no noticeable disturbances of affect. In addition, a review of video when he was Dolphins head coach reveal some of these innate tendencies. One can see his eyes darting as he speaks at a regular weekly press conference in Miami and in the press conference introducing him as Dolphins head coach. When speaking or walking up to the podium, the darting eyes are subdued. He typically wore a cap in Dolphins press conferences.
Sure.
My assumption is he'll do so in New York. The hat tends to shade his eyes, thus obscuring the darting. He's more comfortable not dressed in a suit and wearing a hat.
Take a bird box challenge.
Speaking or performing tasks eases the tendency. Sitting on a stage with nothing to do but listen accentuates them. In his conclusion, this is an actual medical doctor. This should have no effect on his ability to coach football. Thanks, Joe. Bernstein and McKnight. Here on a Thursday on Sports Radio 670, The Score. Started out talking baseball, then we talked some football, and then we talked about whatever pathological condition or not is affecting
Adam. The hell that was.
We talked about that. I love the fact that that much space was allowed to be devoted to that. When you got a doctor on staff, you want to try to diagnose things in the NFL, let him have at it.
It's weird, but he's fine. That was the diagnosis. It's weird. Right. Super weird. He's probably fine.
He's got a thing, but it's probably not really a thing you got to
worry about.
Oh, but
it's a thing. It's definitely a thing. He's probably fine. Did you read, by the way, Ken Rosenthal's whole column? I know we excerpted part of it.
It's troubling to me.
What he did was go back and forth about the – because I mentioned yesterday, every February, the last I think it's four seasons going back to expanded replay for going just past the fair foul stuff, we've had rules changes to Major League Baseball. Every February, the proposals are made somewhere around this time. They hem and haw, they shush and plots, and then they get to actually setting down what the rule changes are going to be. And Tony Clark, the director of the Major League Players Union, has mostly just said no to some of the revised issues that Rob Manfred has tried to push into Major League Baseball. He definitely said no to just about everything he could find last year because the players got took in a collective bargaining agreement whereby the league kept on threatening this international draft thing, which for tons of reasons, a lot of them are, kind of clunky and inside, a lot of reasons was never going to happen. But you had a groundswell of Latin American players speak really loudly for one of the first times in modern baseball history with power in the union saying, no, we are not standing for this. This will not happen. Now, they got hoodwinked a little bit because it was never going to happen, an international draft. But it was used as a bargaining tool.
It was a straw man, though.
It was.
They were able to just sort of throw it and say, well, fine, we'll back off of this when they never had any intention.
But it's important that you had a group of players active in the union, active in this process in a way, in a very, very powerful way.
But that doesn't matter until you are actually willing to not show up for work.
And that's the root of the issue. Rosenthal points out that it's time for the players to come to the table and acquiesce to some of the pace of play, some of the rules changes, some of the, inside things that fans are going to be excited about, I guess, unless they put a runner on second base in extra innings in actual games. I don't think a lot of fans are going to enjoy that. I certainly won't.
I'm open to it.
I'm not. I want nothing to do with that. I am open to other changes if you want to do pitch clocks or whatever. I don't need the runner on second base and extras. Still, this idea that the players have to cave. We had a caller earlier. I think fans in general, or some fans have a sense of, these players make enough. Let's just get this over with and play baseball. That's not how this is going to work.
No, Tony Clark's That's not how job, it should work. His job is not to just accept what the owners are dangling in front of him. He has one job, and that's to advocate for the rank and file. That is to represent and advocate for the player's best interest.
The rank and file who saw their average salary dip for the one of the first times in the last couple of years. Not by much, I admit that, not by a whole lot, but usually it's gone up. The average baseball salary went down from 17 to 18.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that the players decided to go with a former player instead of lawyers and legal experts, instead of somebody like Marvin Miller or Donald Fehr, because the teams are really, really smart. They're run by more brain power than they've ever been run, and the teams now have players under 6 or 7 years of control, at which point they then become free agents that don't get paid.
That's the root of a discontent, I think, among a lot of players, whether they're free agents, guys like Jake Arrieta, who signed his deal, or guys who are under arbitration control, like Chris Bryant, who just got his deal. Like, that's the crux of things, I think, that you're able to withhold salary or suspend salary or earning potential for that long in baseball. And Tom Ricketts talked about it with Mullion Haw earlier this morning, that those guys in arbitration are due raises. They're going to get their pay raises. Chris Bryant's making, what is it, $13 million for the coming season? And that's still...
It's not market value.
That's still going to be under what his... Well, we got to be careful when we say market value too, I guess, because in terms of what a win above replacement costs a team or what they're willing to pay against what the market is willing to pay, like...
If the market
really
is
are
the market,
only two
yeah,
teams
right.
willing to pay Manny Machado $175, that is market value. It's just not what he's actually worth to a baseball team in terms of wins and losses.
We are going to be joined by Ian Rappaport of NFL.com and NFL Network. He's got the latest on everything that's going on, so don't go anywhere. He's next on The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Ian Rappaport.
Here's what we know right now.
Insider for the NFL Network.
Get out your notebook. There's more.
Breaking news across the National Football League.
This is something that has been going on through the wee hours of last night. Really round-the-clock discussions.
The Rap Sheet and Friends podcast.
I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story. And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
Ian Rappaport with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Ian Rappaport joins us now on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. You can find him on Twitter at Rapsheet. He writes for NFL.com and he talks on NFL Network and on the Rapsheet and Friends podcast. This had to be fun. Ronnie Lott and Freddie Kitchens. The more I hear from Freddie Kitchens, the more I want to hear from Freddie Kitchens because that's just two tons of fun right there.
Freddie Kitchens is the best. I've actually known him for... let's say more than at least 10 years, ever since he was a coach, coaching running backs at Mississippi State, actually took over, I believe, for Stan Drayton when he was at Mississippi State. Freddie's a great guy and, you know, the kind of guy who is under the radar, not a self-promoter, just did his job really well, the kind of guy I never thought would get to be a head coach in the league because of that. And yet here he is, which is very cool.
That video when he goes over to Baker Mayfield and just starts tickling his beard. And then Mayfield is just kind of rolling his eyes. And then he goes back and does it again. And he walks away and Mayfield goes, that guy's an idiot. But it seemed like it was a really warm relationship there.
Well, yeah, it's a great relationship. And you know, it was actually fascinating to talk to him. And we got into this some on the podcast just about why he was able to be so successful. And he kept saying, it's not like I was calling different plays. It's not like, you know, I came up with something that no offensive coordinator had come up with. It was, in his mind, getting the guys to believe in him and trust him. And he's like, maybe if guys believe in you, they just do their job a little bit better. They work a little bit harder. They prepare a little bit more. And it's, you know, that's been sort of one of his tenets and philosophies for a long time. He's always had close relationships with his guys, whether it's coaching quarterbacks in Arizona or running backs in Cleveland or whatever. And, you know, on the field, you know, he's right. I mean, one of the things he said was, he's like, look, I've had I've had success everywhere. He's actually right. It's just he sort of never really got noticed until this year.
He's one of the few head coaches who got hired or really even in the last hiring cycle who have skipped some steps to becoming a head coach. You know, he goes from running backs coach to interim OC to head coach. You've had Sean McVay and Matt LaFleur and all these other guys kind of skip the whole process. Not the whole process, but at least a big part of what we thought it was. What are the worries and what are the things these guys do to convince ownership from your conversations with hiring people who make the hires that convince them these are the right guys to put in these positions?
I actually think what it is, you raise a great point because we've seen the last 2 years, you know, like Zach Taylor's getting a job. Zach Taylor was a quarterback's coach. He was a quality control guy 2 years ago, you know, a offensive coordinator at a mid-level, below mid-level place who's now going to be a head coach in the NFL. And, you know, I think it's, we all spend so much time on the Sean McVay effect. Everyone wants to hire Sean McVay's friends and all that. I actually think the biggest thing that McVay's hiring led to was teams no longer want to wait a year. You know, I mean, there were some teams that love Sean McVay in the coaching process. They were like, oh man, when he's ready, he's really going to be great. I just, you know, he's not ready now, but when he is, he's going to be great. And the Rams were like, yeah, we don't care. Like, we're just going to hire him and he's not ready. Like, that's okay. We'll work with him. Like, we just want to get him. And they hired him. And I think it's made teams go, you know what? We don't want to wait. Like, we'll deal with whatever growing pains there are, but we just want to get the right guy. And you saw this year, you know, Matt LaFleur in Green Bay is one. Zach Taylor in Cincinnati is another. The Dolphins are going to hire Brian Flores, who is not yet a defensive coordinator. That's another. I mean, there are the Browns, obviously. There's a lot of examples of teams going, well, we don't want to wait either because we think this guy's our guy.
When does McVay have to win?
Well, I think he took a step this year. I think had he lost that playoff game, there would have started to be the drumbeat of, well, hold on, he's never won a playoff game, whatever. I mean, I actually think now, because he took a step in the right direction, I think now he probably avoided any of that. You know, had he got 0-2 in a playoff game, maybe there would have been some discussion. But, you know, to me, I think whoever ends up winning on Sunday, the other one is not really going to get criticized, nor should they. It's just, you know, it's 1-2 matchup, and I think all four teams are great. And whoever doesn't win, I think will escape the criticism that sometimes comes with big playoff losses.
Do you think, Ian, that Antonio Brown has an end game in mind right now, or is he just responding to those who are calling him out?
I think he's just responding.
Okay.
From what was being reported, some of the frustration involves Juju Smith-Schuster being named the MVP, which, you know, whatever. I get it. He's your teammate. That's frustrating. There's jealousy. I get it. But then for him to derail the final game of the season, I thought it was interesting that I think it's interesting that Art Rooney said yesterday that, you know, well, you know, I guess Antonio Brown did enough to earn his paycheck in week 17, which is to say that he almost didn't. You know, they almost suspended him or docked his pay. I mean, there's some things there. So I do think he's just responding, but each little step along the way, we get another determination of why he's unlikely to respond to unlikely to return to Pittsburgh.
The Bears finally held their end-of-season press conference, and we heard from Matt Nagy and Ryan Pace. There were a couple bits of news, the first being they made it very, very clear that Cody Parkey is not going to be in their plans next year, that they want more production from the position. They were unhappy with the Today Show appearance, etc. I'm told the decision was made before the Today Show appearance, actually, which really didn't surprise anybody. The other thing that came up was they had so many chances to close the door on a Kareem Hunt signing, and the number of times they avoided doing so, and the revelation that Matt Nagy said he just last week was checking up on his guy. This is not unfounded speculation about this possibility. What do you think could happen?
I would agree that it is not unfounded. And you know, a lot of times what happens in the media is we connect the dots. We say, all right, well, you know, this guy coached this player, so now he's up in free agency. Well, maybe then he'll sign there. Well, that actually happens a lot. You know, if you look in free agency, there are plenty of guys who will go to sign with their offensive coordinator who took a head coaching job somewhere. You know, like I mean, this does happen. And I think Kareem Hunt will have served, by the time he gets signed, he will have served his time. He's still probably, you know, I don't know if they're going to do the suspension concurrent or basically give him time served, since he'll essentially have missed a whole season almost, you know, or half a season. Either way, he will have served whatever time he's going to serve. So he has a right to play according to the rules. If the Bears can sort of deal with the backlash from it and make their peace with signing someone who did what he did, then I would, I would think it's a possibility, because if they don't, then the rival might, and that's just life in the NFL.
So, Ian, you're saying you don't expect Kareem Hunt to have a subsequent suspension after he signs with whomever, that where he missed games last season, even though the Chiefs cut him and he wasn't on contract to be suspended, that there won't be more games he's forced to miss next year, you think?
Yeah, I would say it's unclear at this point.
Okay.
I honestly don't know, because the NFL has done it both ways. They've said, well, you know, suspensions don't count. You know, when you're basically a free agent, you're on the commissioner's exempt list, it don't count. But for Adrian Peterson, he was on the commissioner's exempt list and then was basically reinstated after the season, whenever that was, 2013 or whatever that was, just, and it was sort of like time served. Like, they've done it both ways. So I'm saying he may not necessarily have a suspension. You know, he also, I mean, obviously no one's going to sign him now, clearly. So does that count or does that not count? You know, I don't know. And I think what the league sometimes does is they say, all right, well, you know, when you're on this list, it, you know, we're going to give you two additional games and you'll have missed eight total. And that's your kind of time off missing. I think Michael Kendricks with Seattle got some of that, where he was basically taken off the field. And then when he was reinstated, it was like, all right, well, now you've missed a period of, I think it was 10 games or something. That's basically your suspension.
Do you have any expectation of whether or not, whatever team ends up signing him, because I think he will be signed, whatever team ends up signing him, will they know before they sign him what his disciplinary, you know, responsibilities are going to be? Or are they going to have to just kind of take that as the NFL decides it?
Probably will know. I think that's the hope. I mean, obviously for Kareem Hunt, he wants the suspension now. You know,
Deal
with, like, give me whatever it is. Let me serve it. I think, you know, he wanted it yesterday. He wanted it 5 weeks ago, whatever it was. They wanted to fast track it. The NFL wants to make sure they don't end up in a situation like they did with the Giants kicker, when you suspend a guy once and then a couple weeks later there are more things and you need to suspend them again. When the NFL wants to, that's why they're so thorough, to make sure there's not. I mean, from the Kareem Hunt situation, first it was, there was the video, and then all of a sudden it was, well, actually there's two other incidents. You know, so we'll see how many officially he's suspended, but you know, it should be more than six games that he's not allowed in the field, because it's the personal conduct violation with the violence against the woman, and then it's two other separate incidents. So either way, he's going to be off the field for a while.
Before we let you go, what interests you most about each one of these championship games that will be heard on The Score on Sunday?
I would say the Patriots-Chiefs. It's really, this is not like rocket surgery or whatever, but it's really just the quarterbacks, you know, because Tom Brady, I know, never loves when another young quarterback gets all this love. Like, I remember covering him, you'd ask him, like, oh, how great is this young quarterback? And he'd be like, yeah, you know, we're focused on what we wanted. He doesn't like talking about the young quarterbacks. He doesn't like someone else coming in and just taking the shine. So I imagine whatever you're going to see is going to be Brady's best, and I'm fascinated to which quarterback ends up making the most important or the last play there. And I would say with the Rams Saints game, I mean, I would expect this to be a grinded out sort of low scoring run game, which is kind of weird. I know, but it feels like that's where both of these teams are headed. I'm going to be really fascinated if CJ Anderson, who was on his couch, who didn't think that he was going to be in the NFL again, if he ends up being the star of this game. I mean, the NFL is so weird, and it happens every year where some dude is signed like in December and ends up making the difference in the biggest game of the season. Like, that could be CJ Anderson again. Of all the great players in the game, that's the guy I'm kind of wondering, like, what are we going to see?
That's it. When you say on his couch, First of all, that's a strong couch.
Literally on his couch, sitting on the couch.
No question. You're not just using a phrase there. Ian, thank you very much, as always.
All right, thanks, guys.
That is Ian Rappaport. Time for your chance to win $1,000 in cash on the score. This hour's keyword is cowboy. How about them cowboys? Text cowboy to 72881 by the end of the hour. Again, the keyword is cowboy to 72881. One randomly selected nationwide entrant from this hour will win. Please don't text and drive. Message and data rates may apply. I've got
stuff and things?
Yeah, I do. I have Super Blood Wolf Moon. Super Blood Wolf
Moon. Is
that
a video game?
And I'm going to ask you to ask the question that was asked by Rene Magritte. So when is a pipe not a pipe?
Disappointing news for a show favorite t-shirt that we all need. And I have been validated, even though I might still be crazy. The Midday Midway is next. It's Bernstein McKnight, 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.